your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
All of us can get anxious at work. For example, if we have an upcoming performance review by a boss who's unreasonable. But some people are anxious too much of the time. And the anxiety doesn't dissipate when they enter the workplace door. If that sounds like you, might any of these help? Let's start with if your anxiety is generalized. That is, even many little things worry you more than they would other people. If that's you, might you want to accept that that's simply part of your makeup, just like any other tough-to-fix handicap? We all have one or more of those, whether it's bad looks or low intelligence, a physical disease, psychological problem. Even if you do if you're one of those people who's just generally an anxious human being, even if you do the standard anxiety reducers, exercise, deep breathing, maybe psychotherapy, you know, more likely than not, you will still be more anxious than are most people, and that's okay. Plenty of anxious people do well at work and in personal life. Candidly, I've seen more worry warts do well and not be unduly unhappy. Yeah, they wish they were kicked back sometimes, but I have seen more worry warts do well than do kickback types. In fact, anxious people on average just might do better than kickback types because anxiety, at least a moderate amount of it, or a modest at least amount of it, can indicate that you're a caring person. But let's say you're anxious about something specific. There is a tendency, of course, to avoid thinking about that painful subject in the same way as a paramecium, if you poke it, is going to move away. Instead, and it's easier for me to say than to do, but to try to do the obviously correct thing, that is to make yourself think about what, if anything, you could do about it. That's going to reduce your anxiety at least somewhat, and then make yourself take the baby steps to get started. Like, let's say, you know, so many people are afraid of being fired or, quote, laid off. Would you replace you? Ask yourself. That's a hard question. If you were the boss, would you replace you? And if so, is it hopeless? There's a personality conflict that just can't be resolved? Or would upskilling in something, whether it be a hard skill or a soft skill like communication or sales or whatever, help? Or do you need to be more political? I hate it, but America is the land of politics. In and outside of official politics, in most workplaces, having a great relationship with upper management and people below you, because those people below you can go and sabotage you and go over your head and talk to your boss and get you fired. Do you need to play the unfortunate American game? And maybe it's worldwide, but I have a hard enough time keeping up with what's here in the Bay Area, let alone nationwide, let alone worldwide. But do you need to play politics more? Make a list of every stakeholder, your peers, your bosses, people working under you, even customers. And you need to treat each of them and say, do I need to do more without violating your ethics to build a positive relationship so that if at minimum, when you do screw up, and we all screw up, they'll have your back? Or if you haven't screwed up, but maybe they're jealous for your job or simply jealous of your looks. I've seen in many workplaces, there are workers who try to sabotage the good looking person in the workplace merely because they're jealous. So do you need to be, if you're an anxious person, I'm trying to give you some perspective here. If you're an anxious person, you're afraid of being fired or laid off, would you replace yourself? And if that's true of your status quo, do you want to upskill? Do you want to think of it as a hopeless personality problem? Do you need to play more office politics? Do you need to improve your attitude? Some people just do the least work they can get away with. I mean, I remember reading that study I quoted to you a couple of weeks ago that said that they did a poll of 1,000 people. The average worker works less than 3 hours a day of actual work, although claiming to work full time. Do you need to improve your attitude? Do you need to roll with the punches a little more? Are you so high maintenance that you're seen as just difficult? Or the other way around, you're just so compliant that they feel like you're easily taken advantage of or gotten rid of? And occasionally, I had a client not so long ago who was really good at negotiating a salary. And he got really a higher amount of money than him, many of his peers in and outside of his field were getting for that kind of work. And in the course of our conversation, we conclude, and he felt that there was some, he was at risk of being laid off. So I said, might you want to voluntarily take a pay cut? And he said, yes. And he did, and that, there's no guarantees, as far as I know, he's still working there. But it provides a measure of insulation. You don't want to stick out as being overpaid, because that makes you particularly easily laid off. So my point is, if you're an anxious, if you're a laid back person, this may not be that critical. But if you're an anxious person by nature, and you have that most common fear in the workplace of being fired or laid off, you know, the tendency is to avoid thinking about it. But, and we don't like to use the word force yourself, but in the real world, in the end, people need to force themselves to do the uncomfortable thing, because it's too easy to literally or metaphorically get a burrito. So take a real look and ask yourself that hard question, like, would you replace yourself? And if so, what can you do to improve? Another example. Another common fear, a specific fear that people have, obviously, is public speaking. Let's say you got to give a talk at a meeting, and you're going to afraid you're going to sound stupid. That's the real fear. You're going to be stupid. You're going to screw up. Well, anxious people do, again, tend to avoid thinking about their speech until the last second, so they can spend less time worrying. It's a temporarily escape. Of course, that, rather than starting the practice earlier, is going to increase the risk of the fear coming true. So do you need to force yourself to say, darn it, I'm going to give this talk. If I don't give this talk, I'm going to get into more trouble. Force, you know, the art, it's so important to learn to be uncomfortable. Sometimes we are better off being uncomfortable in the long run and willing to accept the short-term uncomfortability for the long-term comfortability. I'm now starting to do my taxes. I hate having to devote. It takes me about a week out of my year. And I resent it. I hate it. I would love to just write a check or send them Venmo, but with no work. But I've got to, in order to, you know, I've got to be especially cautious because my wife's a public figure. I'm really careful. And that takes a lot of time for me to be careful and pay a lot of taxes. I hate it, but I do it. And so I don't even think about whether it's an option. I force myself to take the next baby step. I've got a big box of all my receipts, and I have a room that I actually, this is my daughter's bedroom. I allocate her bed as the place where I lay out all of the receipts, and I categorize them. And I just take the next baby step. Okay, I'm going to carry the box downstairs. I'm going to go and I'm going to take the W-2s and 1099s and I'm going to put them in one pile. I just make myself do it, as corny as it sounds. There's a whole self-help industry and a time management and procrastination industry that writes books about, you know, you must avoid fear of failure and fear of success, fear of being embarrassed. In the end, sometimes we can't fight through our fears, but I'm talking about garden variety fears here. In the end, at the risk of seeming insensitive, certainly the first line of defense against procrastination is to force yourself through it if it's something you should be doing. Sometimes your voice is telling you correctly, this is not worth doing. Or yes, you can indeed weigh you have more important things to do now. Of course, absolutely. But in general, when you know, when the goddess within you, the god within you, the wise man or wise woman within you says, I should be doing this damn thing now because I've got this speech coming up, or I'm about to get fired or laid off if I don't improve. To, yes, force yourself to face it and then take baby steps. At the risk of sounding cliched, that sometimes cliches become cliches because they're so on target. One more example. Job seekers. Job seekers can get particularly anxious. And here, it's a matter of very often changing what they used to call your erroneous thinking. Let's say you're afraid as a job seeker to reach out to people, to, you know, for your career connections or for romance, whatever. And you could harbor that fear of reaching out for a number of reasons. Let's say, as I mentioned just a moment ago, let's say you fear rejection. You've got to remind yourself, and I don't mean to sound preachy, but sometimes you need to in order for it to be helpful. If you're afraid of rejection, remind yourself that you can survive lots of rejection. It just means that you haven't yet found the right employer, the right networking contact. We're kind of like a musical note. we can harmonize only with a small percentage of the other notes. Let's say you fear imposing. You're imposing on, you know, cold calling somebody or imposing on your network. You got to remind yourself that you have been willing to impose on a stranger when you're asking for directions, a stranger. And in asking somebody you know, a networking contact, for information or a job lead, you're imposing no more. You're not asking for a handout. If the person doesn't want to give you more than a few seconds, the person could say so. And if they choose to give you more, it's their choice. Many people like to help other people. By the way, I should apologize. I'm just coming out of a cold, so you're hearing a little hoarseness. This is, for those of you just joining us, this is not my normal voice, but hopefully it's not annoying enough to make you hate me. So I will sally on forth. Another reason that job seekers especially are reluctant to push themselves forward and they're anxious about it is they're afraid of being embarrassed. If you can, try to force yourself to use that fear to motivate you to practice, for example, if you're talking about your networking or for a job interview. Maybe first script your elevator pitch, then reduce it to a few word outline, because you certainly don't want to memorize your pitch, you're going to leech all the chemistry. And then attempt, using just that few word outline, attempt to give your elevator speech by yourself, maybe talking into your webcam or your phone's voice recorder, or with a friend. And if you do end up sounding, you know, and then when you need to keep practicing until you're decent at it, but not scripted, because like I said, you'll sound terrible. But let's say you do now, you've practiced, but you still screw up and you sound terrible and you're embarrassed. It does help to remember that, of course, you will have chances with other people. And you know, here's a tip, by the way. Do try out, let's say, whether it be for job interviews or networking pitches or whatever, that you try out your pitch on your least desired contacts first, so that you have the opportunity to work out the kinks before you try it on your prime prospects. Remember, you really can survive being a screw-up or having screwed up. You know, at the risk of sounding like your mother or father, when you were learning to ride your bike and fell off, what did your father and mother say? Get right back on the bike. You won't have the fears build up, and that way you'll get better. So those are my thoughts about the anxious employee. But those are kind of generic pieces of advice that are drawn from my 5,500 clients that I've worked with. But I'm interested in helping you. If you suffer from anxiety, especially at work, and would like a more customized solution, I'd be delighted if you call right now. This is the time to do it here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW. For what I call a workover, I'll ask you some questions and see if we can create a customized approach to, if not eliminating your anxiety, that's not realistic, but keeping it more under control, managing it better. The phone number here for that, what I call a workover, here at Work with Marty Nemco is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Calls are already coming in, so I'm not going to start talking about, they're all coming in, so I'm not going to start. I'm just going to wait a moment until we can get the calls through. We don't use a screener here, for those of you who don't know. We're just putting them mechanically on the line. This is really democratic radio. We take them in the order received. And I think by trusting you, my listeners, I have never been burned. There's nobody who said, oh, good, I can say a four-letter word. I love my listeners for that and many other reasons. Anyway, let's go to the phones now. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hey, Marty, how you doing?
I am well. What gives me the honor of the call?
I'm just looking for any kind of advice. I'm a young professional just starting out, graduated from college a year ago, and I'm trying to take the steps to change the industry. What I went into originally wasn't really that satisfying, and frankly I think it would be really interesting to get a museum job or something somewhere in an intellectual field or perhaps education, so I can be encouraged to keep learning as much as possible. But I'm just really terrified about taking that first step, and you know, I don't have much experience with reaching out to networks and all that. I was just wondering if you had any advice.
I love it. I'm really glad you called. Let's take it a step at a time. So I hear the real drive behind wanting to change is wanting to keep learning. Tell me about, you said I want to change the industry. I had visions of you trying to change the way the whole culture is in the industry. But I think you mean is you want to change out of your current industry into another one. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. What's your current industry?
Real estate.
Okay. Commercial or residential?
Both.
In sales or something else?
We do sales and property management.
Okay, but your role, were you a property manager? Were you a sales guy? Were you a bird dog doing research? Were you an evaluator? What were you doing?
Bird dog and office management.
Okay, and what, if anything, did you like about the job and about the field?
I really liked the potential in it for money. Okay. I mean, long term, it seemed like a good investment, but seeing how much work it would actually take to get that payoff, I don't think it's all that worth it.
Okay, where'd you go to college?
I went to a Loyola Marymount in LA.
Okay, yeah, I've been there. And what did you major in?
English and theater.
Great. Okay. What made you choose Loyola Marymount? It's an odd choice for a Northern California kid. Usually, kids who want to go to Catholic colleges, they usually go to St. Mary's here or Santa Clara or USF. What made you decide to go to Loyola?
It was the best school that I got into at the time.
Okay.
And I was really fascinated with LA. I really liked it. I just wanted to be there.
Yeah. And English and theater. Why'd you pick English and theater as majors?
Well, I picked theater because I like acting and performing and being in front of other people.
Me too.
I picked English because I like reading and writing.
Okay. And in what aspect of your English major and theater major was it all transformative for you, or a major growth spurt for you? What was valuable in that for you?
English taught me how to read and how to listen, ironically enough, because The more I read, the more I was able to hear people out.
Lovely.
Knowing that, like, you have to understand a full story before you can have thoughts about it.
Critical skill. The Jesuits would love you.
Yeah. We got along well.
Right. Good. Okay. And theater.
Theater just made me realize that it was okay to be myself, and that it's okay to want attention and to like being in front of people, and to not really have to shy away from that part of myself, to just say like it's okay to be who I am.
You're right.
Really just drink myself up.
Yeah, as long as you're serving others, you can. You know, the being in public is a really valuable thing. It can be used for evil. It can be used for good. So that all sounds pretty darn cool. And then how did you end up in real estate with that kind of a background?
My family did it, and I was just looking for a job.
Yeah. Okay. And is your real interest in museum learning and education learning, or is it more that you want to keep learning?
My real interest is in performing, but I love learning, and I only realized that after I got out of school, and I never want to stop. I want to keep learning every single day.
Great. So we're going to play a game, and the game is called the optometry game. Have you ever been to the eye doctor to get fitted for contact lenses or glasses?
Yep.
And they put this thing in front of your eyes, and they show you two lenses, and they say, is it better with lens one or lens two? And then after a while, you can't tell, and you feel stupid?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I'm going to give you two careers that involve learning and performing, and you simply tell me which feels better, okay?
All right.
Would you rather be a trainer of something, like training on fundraising or training in sales, or would you rather be a high school teacher?
Ooh. I'd rather be a teacher, I guess.
Okay. And if you could choose any grade to teach or any subject to teach, what grade and what subject?
I would teach high school history.
Cool. And, okay, so now we're back to the optometry game. Would you rather be a high school history teacher, or would you rather teach English to adult immigrant adults?
High school history.
High school history. Would you rather teach high school history in what place in the world would you like to teach high school history?
In America, somewhere.
Would it be in the Bay Area, Los Angeles, Arkansas? Where would it be?
I don't know.
Play with me. Make a guess. Fantasize. Let's say it was a dream.
Either California or Virginia or Carolina.
Cool.
Or Alaska.
All right. Now, okay, great. and I want you to trust the wise men within you. Those are very different cultures. California's the most expensive climate. It's the best. It's the most multicultural for people. Many people love that. Alaska is really, it is still a pioneering, adventurous kind of people, and it's certainly very cold winters and such. North Carolina is much lower cost of living and extraordinarily diverse in terms of, it's got high intellectuality at the Research Triangle, but it's also got really artsy communities like in Asheville and the like, and also a lot of poor places like Charlotte. Which of those feels like where you would thrive, not forever, but where would you thrive as a human being and as a professional over the next, say, 5 years?
Carolina.
Great. And where in Carolina? Would it be more the Research Triangle, Raleigh-Durham, where Duke is, and the University of North Carolina, at Chapel Hill is? Or would it be more artsy like Asheville? Would it be more a low-income community like Western North Carolina? Where would you be?
Probably between Asheville and Research.
Okay. And so we're now going to create... What's your first name?
Dan.
Dan, we're going to create a Dan meter. The Dan meter goes from 0 to 10. Well, 0 means the idea makes you puke, and 10 means it gives you ecstasy. The idea of being a high school history teacher somewhere in North Carolina in a place that would feel geographically comfy for you, what does that score on the meter?
3 or 4.
Good. Not that it's good, but I appreciate the honesty. Remember, 10 is great, and 0 stinks. What keeps that from being a 10?
I still want to perform. I don't want to give up on that yet.
What if I said teaching is performing, and you get to perform 1,000 times as much, and you can always, like most performers, you know, I'm very involved in the world of community theater, and the people who are involved in community theater get many more acting roles and cool acting roles than if they tried to make it as professional, where they get every once in a while they get cast in a commercial and they got to stand around waiting and big deal, so they're selling toilet paper. So what if I said the best way to be a performer is to teach, where you're performing all day and then do your acting chops, whether it's making videos with you as the protagonist on YouTube as a hobby, or community theater, or do audition, you know, find an agent down there in Raleigh-Durham and get to do commercials. What if I said that's the right balance? Are you saying, Marty, you don't understand, or am I right on the money?
No, I'd be closer like you don't understand.
Okay, tell me, explain that to me.
It's not a bad idea. I mean, it seems like it could be fun, and I might even enjoy myself a lot, but...
You want to perform? Does performing mean on stage, in movies, in YouTube videos, in what?
Either on stage or in radio or in YouTube, something.
Radio's volunteer. Nobody makes any money in radio anymore. I got to tell you, it really is the truth. You know, I can't be dishonest. Yeah, you know, the top people in the nation make money, but you know, I've been doing this 30 years. I love doing it. I don't get a penny, and I'm not afraid of negotiating. It's just that's the word, you know. Radio, even in podcasting, is still kind of an old school medium, and YouTube, because it's free, it's accessible to everybody, that's not where the money is. You know, in order to make money being on stage, that's why I mentioned a bit about being a trainer, a corporate trainer, because then you're going to get paid for, again, being on stage all the time. It's pretty tough, unless you're a great musician who's got amazing chops. I have a client who is a very famous rock musician, a young guy in his 20s, but he's worth $50 million because people go to his enormous, and he's one guy, but he's got this enormous electronic setup, and millions of people come, and he sits at his computer at home answering all these Facebook fans. You know, do you have that kind of potential?
Yes.
Yup. Okay. Great. Then what you need, because you're young and you sound like you're unattached, then you owe it to yourself. If you're my son, I would be telling you the same thing. I want you to circle a date on your calendar. It could be 1 year from now, 2 years from now, maybe even 3 years from now. And I want you to put a picture, a JPEG of you on stage with your guitar or whatever the heck it is, on the stage at the, you know, at the a fancy auditorium, wherever you want to you envision yourself, and make a to-do list of what you need to do every day, 8 hours a day, not 12. I'm not turning you into a workaholic, but if you're working on any other job, you'd be working 8 hours a day. Give yourself a to-do list that keeps you busy 8 hours a day, improving your chops, improving your act, improving your marketing, finding partners, finding agents, doing, you know, recording, doing whatever the hell it is, and then you will either win in which case you say, I've defied the odds and you've lived the life you want to live as a performer. Or when you reach that red letter day that you've circled on your calendar, you say, you know what? I gave it a good shot, but the world is telling me they don't want to give me even a sustainable living as a performer. How do you feel about that being the plan?
Sounds like a good plan.
All right. I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Hey, and Dan, by the way, are you gone yet?
No.
Good. You can tell I put all of my energy into everything I do, including this call. So the only thing I ask back is, you know, call us back to let, you know, you have a good number of people having listened to you here right now. If you call back in, say, 6 months and tell them what worked, what didn't work, all the people who are listening will benefit from your experience. Will you commit to me to do that?
Sure.
All right, cool. Thanks, Dan.
Have a good one.
Be well. All right, we got plenty of calls on the line. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, yes. My name is Elhan, and I'm a licensed insurance advisor.
Said Elhan or Johan? I didn't get it.
Elhan, E-L-H-A-M.
Thank you. Elhan. Okay. Elhan, okay. Go ahead.
So the question is regarding anxiety at work.
Okay.
So I studied consumer behavior and industrial psychology for my master's degree, and I'm now a licensed insurance advisor. I never really quite saw a clear path where that led.
Right.
But the window of opportunity opened, and I just took it. And now I just want to feel like I'm really, truly living up to my full potential. I mean, this isn't stemming from my degree. My bachelor's was in psychology, and trying to grow with this wonderful startup that I'm in, but I want to make sure that I'm adding value to the company as a team member, and I see growth potential and advancement opportunities, and I am also like one of the oldest members on my team, and it just kind of feels like I'm maybe not sure if this is the right pathway. I mean, if it fails, I mean, I'm sticking with it now, but if it fails, you know, this isn't exactly giving me experience on what I studied, so I don't even know what my fallback plan would be.
Okay.
So it just kind of gives me anxiety every day on how I might be able to feel stable, that I'm you know, chipping away at the right block.
Again, I'm really happy you called. That's a nice phrase, by the way, chipping away at the right block. I'm going to paint a vision for how someone could, in your job and in your role, add, to use your term, add as much value as possible to the company, leveraging the things that you say you're interested in. And if the company succeeds, terrific. And if not, you then have stories to tell that can leverage it to do the similar kind of thing with another employer, perhaps in an industry that is more aligned with who you want to be. So if I had a background in consumer behavior, industrial psychology, or whatever, and I'm working for a bunch of insurance advisors who's advising businesses on what kind of insurance to get and reinsure and self-insure and the rest of it, I would try to be putting my hat on, even if it wasn't part of my official job duties, and I would look at the organization as a whole, but also individuals, key individuals, and ask them, how could I either offer training to them that would enable them to better serve their customers, or create better esprit de corps and teamwork among them, and make that a part of my job so that you become a beloved piece of glue to the whole organization. To what extent do you already do that, and to what extent would doing that be a plus, both in ensuring your longevity in this current job, but also allowing you to grow in your skills and use your abilities that could then help you in a subsequent job?
Okay. Okay.
Did you understand what I said?
Right. So find out how I can become the glue for them and increase my value by showing, offer training to individuals, key individuals, to see how I can increase my value in that way.
Or groups. Does that feel real, you know, to leverage what you care about and know in the area of consumer behavior? You could do a training on the art of understanding the consumer, whether it be the consumer, be the intermediate consumer, that is the company that's buying insurance, or it could be their customer or whatever, but doing trainings in what you care about that is nonetheless also relevant to your staff members, whether as an individual or doing group training, or if your work group is not getting along well with each other, or some subset within the group is not getting along well with each other, offering to do a workshop, facilitate a workshop with them, or take them out to lunch and do this informally. But utilize, may look for opportunities as they could be, exist. They don't have to exist already, but look for opportunities to use those skills and values you have. And if you need permission, of course, chat with your boss about it. You might even have a chat with your boss that says, you know, I really want to add as much value as I can here. I feel I've got this expertise in consumer behavior and industrial relations. I'm not sure I'm fully using it. Can we brainstorm to see how I might add more value? Do you want to have that conversation with your boss or no?
I would. I've already mentioned that conversation a couple times regarding adding value, but I haven't particularly touched upon the exact field that I came from, because most of us were hired without having prior insurance knowledge.
Exactly.
And there was a reasoning for that. To bring in fresh minds and to bring in, you know, a fresh look and perspective on a lot of the things and processes that we do. I'm just, you know, not exactly performing the same way as my peers who are much younger than me, who are more well-versed in the technology of today. And I just feel like I'm always playing catch-up and without showing my, showing the metrics that the others are showing in their role. Mm-hmm. I feel I haven't been able to get those projects that would increase that value, since maybe I haven't been showing the same level of performance as my peers, since I'm just playing catch up all the time trying to learn the new processes of today.
It may be that depending on the job, you may have to learn that, but you may say, on the other hand, you know, I'm so far behind in this, let me add value in the way that I could add more value. And that would be a discussion to have with your boss. Say, you know, I'm willing to struggle through to try to learn the software better or learn the insurance industry better, but I've got this existing knowledge base that I think I could add real value that ultimately ends up not only to the bottom line, but to the human bottom line within both our staff and your customers, and see if he or she bristles at that or embraces it. But, you know, that way you're building on strengths rather than remediating weaknesses. What do you think?
That could be a potential. Unfortunately, our marketing team is in another side of the country,
okay.
Actually outside of the country. But then again, I could maybe utilize the HR side of things that I studied by, we're hiring on HR individuals soon, and I was trying to maybe ask if I could be an assistant or somehow assist with the projects of the HR individual so that I'm at least harnessing, you know, what I've studied. So I feel at least, you know, value in what I went to school for. Otherwise, I just feel like I could have maybe done this job without having a master's.
There's another way to look at it. We all know that workforces are getting ever more global. Remote workforces, my guest on my show last week, was talking about the proliferation of global workforces. The person who knows how to manage somewhere where somebody's in Chennai and somebody's in Mumbai and somebody is in Glendale, is going to be of increasing value. So if you indeed have a far-flung workforce, offering to do a training with them, and maybe if you're not ready to do that yet, read up on that, take a course yourself in that. But those are ways to leverage both your background as well as where the job market is headed. And if your particular company goes out of business or they fire you, having had that kind of experience, whether it's improving the quality of the organization locally or remotely, or training people on the art of consumer behavior, can be things that you could talk about in subsequent interviews and put on your resume. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you so much.
Take care. You are listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I again apologize for my voice. Just coming on the back end of a cold. Hopefully my voice is not too annoying. I'll give out the phone number again. If you have a work-related problem of any sort, we're talking about the anxious employee. If you are anxious about any aspect of your work life, I don't care if you're 16 or 76, for-profit, non-profit, government, high-level, low-level, CEO or clerk, all the common denominator here is anxiety. If you're anxious about something about your work life, this is the time to call for what I call a workover. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's the number here at KALW, where I do my pro bono work once a week here to answer your questions as best as I can for free. 415-841-4134. I want to take one more call before I move on to another topic. So welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hi, are you there?
Are you talking to me?
I am.
Yes. I'm sorry. Nobody came on the line, so I wasn't sure whether I was next or not.
You are.
But, yeah, I actually called in a couple of weeks ago, and you asked me to call in again because I called in at the very end.
Great.
There was only like 2 seconds to talk.
Right.
So with me, so I work in marketing, and I've never stayed at any job for very long, and I'm thinking maybe it's because maybe I should be doing something else besides marketing. What got me into marketing was writing. I really enjoy writing a lot. So maybe, you know, there's something else I can consider. I'll think about maybe employee communications, but I know you need experience to get into that. So I just wanted to talk to you about other ideas that you may have that, you know, that I could do.
Great. Let's play with let's play the same game on the optometry game I played with the previous caller, but let's do it with writing. Let's, because you know, whatever a client or a caller brings up herself right away is usually important. You've been thinking about getting on this phone call with me.
And yes.
So what? All kinds of things filter out, and the word writing is what stayed top of mind. So I'm going to share two writing-centric careers, and you tell me which feels better, and then we'll keep going until we find you can't tell a difference, and we'll. But at least that should help us. Okay. So would you rather write fundraising letters, or would you rather write annual reports?
A fundraising letter.
Would you rather write fundraising letters or the in-house corporate newsletter?
I think in-house corporate newsletter.
Would you rather be the in-house corporate newsletter, or would you rather write patient information booklets and information on the website?
No, the corporate newsletter.
Okay. Would you rather write for a corporate newsletter or a nonprofit newsletter?
Nonprofit. But nonprofits don't make any money, so that's what I worry about.
Okay, which do you choose? We all probably make our choices.
Okay, I'll still say nonprofit.
Okay, because again, it depends on the size of the nonprofit. If there was one nonprofit you would feel particularly stoked to be writing for, do you know what that might be?
A nonprofit. I was interested in the American Academy of Ophthalmology.
Interesting. Now, I'm always interested when my client says something anomalous. That would be the last thing in the world I would have expected a caller to say. Why that?
Well, I actually came from the optometry ophthalmology field,
okay.
And I've always been interested in the eye.
I love it. Why were you interested in the... Again, that's anomalous, too. Why the eye?
Well, actually, when I was in graduate school, I studied visual pigment. That was Rudolph, and it tells you about the first steps of the visual process.
Love it. Okay. Yeah. Now... Those are huge organizations, both the Optometrist Association and the Ophthalmologist Associations. They have all kinds of communicators, people who write grant proposals. They have people who write to the members, to the existing members, to get them to continue to subscribe and be members, to solicit presenters, to write abstracts afterwards, to create the programs. And what I love about that is that relatively few people want to do it. I'm always afraid when I say, what do you want to write about? You're going to say one of the top, I want to write about sports, or I want to write about the environment, or I want to write about how much I hate Donald Trump. You know, so, but half the Bay Area wants to do that. But half the Bay Area doesn't want to write about optometry or ophthalmology. So the competition is less, and yet those are very viable fields.
Yeah.
So if I said the answer is... to send some writing samples to the director of communications at both of those entities, and maybe even, because those are such big organizations, there are state chapters. You know, they may indeed, you know, whether it be full-time or part-time, hire people to be doing that writing. And if you, you know, you have enough optometric knowledge to be able to write intelligently, if you know, about the biochemical, things that are going on within the intraocularly, that's going to give you a huge edge over your generic writing person. If
right,
I said that,
right.
that, we don't know if that's where you're going to end up, but that's a place to start. I'll give you one, an odd thing. I'm very involved with the Society for Neuroscience.
Oh, really? Okay.
And the Society for Neuroscience, one of the hot fields is something called optogenetics, where they're you know, I don't even know what the hell it is, to tell you the truth, but it's clearly eye-related.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, sounds interesting.
Right. And so, you know, you may start out with the American Optometric Association and the American Academy of Ophthalmologists, but they may say, no, we don't have anything right now. But they may tell you about something. You just happen to hear a talk show host who happens to know about the Society for Neuroscience. But... you may, by talking to those guys and women, of course, you may find side paths that you never would have thought of, but you're starting with something that is not so overcrowded as sports, fashion, the environment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Then go forth and do that. And again, you know, a few months from now, when the smoke is cleared and you're either a wild success, still struggling, or somewhere in the middle, give a call back and give a report. What do you think?
Okay, that sounds great.
Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
All right, thank you.
Yep. I always do prioritize you. I have other stuff I want to do, but I'll take one more call. All right, welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Hi, beautifully.
Great. I am a flight attendant, and I work for a company that was recently bought by another company.
Yep.
And very quickly, we were integrated over a couple years, 2 years, 3 years, and now we are in the first stages of cross-flying on each other's fleet.
Okay.
The first company flew Airbus, the second company flies Boeing. And if the topic is anxiety, I don't feel trained.
You've cut out. You've got to back up 3 seconds. You cut out. Please say it again.
I don't feel like the flight attendants were adequately cross-trained. I feel like it was a very quick process. And
wow, even though it took 2 or 3 years. I was thinking, when you said 2 or 3 years, I was thinking that was darn slow.
2 to 3 years for the policies, for a lot of the bureaucratic stuff, but the nuts and bolts of flying was a very quick 2-day training.
Huh.
And I know the anxiety levels on both sides were extremely high.
Okay.
That being said, the world is a crazy place. Planes are going down, and I think a lot of people in my position feel extremely nervous, scared, fearful, and I think it is something to be addressed, for sure.
So we got a couple of choices here. Tell me which feels most like you. One could be a cold-hearted statistician and say, you know, you heard about the Ethiopia, you see two planes go, you know, Boeing went down, but still, statistically, you are much safer flying than you are driving or in walking in most neighborhoods. So get over it, kid, and just buck up.
True.
You know, so that's one approach.
Thanks.
The other approach, the more kindly approach, would be to say to yourself, okay, what am I and my fellow pilot, my fellow flight attendants, nervous about? And let's go out for a drink together, and let's make up a list of all the things that scare us that we're not sure about, and let's submit the list of questions to whoever the training poobah is or to who our boss, and do that. The third is to quit and say, this is a scummy airline, I'm moving to another airline. And really, none of them are right or wrong. They're really what you feel is, you know, trusting the goddess within yourself. Which of those feels right for you?
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of bouncing back between all three of those choices. Bouncing around, you know. It is a hot topic, and I think I'm nervous about calling in, but...
No.
You know, we're talking about anxiety in the workplace, and I think that I'm not the only one that feels
got it. Okay, so there's an easy answer. So I'm going to make this. If you're bouncing back, I'm going to stop the bouncing. This is what you should do at the risk of being mansplaining. This is what you should do. You should not do it yourself. You say a number of your other flight attendants feel the same way. Then you need to do option two. You and a few of your flight attendants need to get together over coffee or a drink or whatever the hell it is. And you need to make a list of the top 10 questions. You don't want to overwhelm them, but start with something manageable. Brainstorm the top 10 questions that are going to reduce your anxiety and increase patient safety. That's going to do a lot of good for all the subsequent flight attendants and passengers and even pilots. You're also not going to get fired if 10 of you are writing. The letter you're going to send is going to be signed by all of you.
Right.
And that way everybody wins, anxiety is reduced, and that is what this mansplainer says you should do. What do you think?
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for calling the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Keep flying, kiddo.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
I will. Thank
all right.
You.
Good. Bye-bye. All right. Now we're going to change topics a bit. You know, I think we all try to find, you know, what is wisdom? And we all aspire to wisdom. And it would be hubristic of me to assert that my attempts at wisdom have reached that high bar that's wisdom. But I wanted to share with you my best thoughts, at my best shots at what I think are wisdom that relate to work. First is to structure your life to limit negative emotional triggers. The honest truth, if we're being really honest, and I'm always trying to be honest with you and my clients and everybody, we can refine ourselves, but we can't fundamentally change our basic nature. If you, more than the average bear, struggle with sadness or anger, worry, lack of focus, particularly if your struggles are what are called high-functioning or subclinical, that is, they're enough to make you feel bad, but they're not bad enough to keep you from functioning, the wisest approach is to structure your life, rather than try to keep changing yourself, structure your life as much as you can to limit your exposure to people, to places, and situations that trigger you. Like, let's say you're prone to anger. Try, and you can't always do it, but try to limit your contact with colleagues, acquaintances, family members who push your buttons. If you get sad easily, consider careers in which you're in an upbeat environment, like haircutter, or summer camp director, or work for a toy company, although sometimes even any company can be a pressure cooker, be an optometrist where you're helping nearly every patient. So that's my first attempt at wisdom. Try to, instead of endlessly trying to improve yourself, try to structure your life to accept your basic self, but structure it so that it avoids your common weaknesses. Next is, and I've said this before, but it's so central, it makes me so sad. I have a number of my young clients, especially men, I'll be honest, young men clients who are just disproportionately valuing making a lot of money, even when they come from families that have money. And so my second attempt at wisdom is to not chase money beyond a middle-class income. Too often, the increase in happiness is dwarfed by the reduction in career options. Think about some of the previous callers to the show. We had somebody who was insurance advising. I'm not sure the other one was in commercial real estate. Some people love it and can do it ethically and make the world a better place, but a lot of them are doing it just for the money. It's a big price to pay if you're doing it for the money. These days, I got to tell you, not only do you have fewer career options if you're going for money, but there is an increase in stress and an increase in ethical temptations. And I've said this before, but I'm not all of you are listening with bated breath week after week. These days, government jobs, especially federal, often offer a particularly enticing deal. And a lot of people think federal jobs are in D.C. No, we have two huge office buildings of federal employees in Oakland and one big one in San Francisco. There's tons of jobs here, right? Government offers really competitive salaries very often in most fields, outstanding benefits, and absolutely nonpareil security of employment. Now, a corollary of what I just said is you really have to recognize that status is a false god. Yeah, in some cases, the higher price or the brand name may mean a better quality product is worth the money, but that's rarely true. Especially true of like the biggest purchase we make, like homes and cars and education. I mean, a tract home or a duplex in an okay neighborhood, say in a mid-sized city, not San Francisco, but let's say in, Pinole or Concord, Clayton, Tracy. That only costs infinitely less to buy or to rent than some McMansion in some Tony suburb like San Francisco or, like a Piedmont or the fancy neighborhoods in Oakland or a penthouse apartment. Excuse me. But, it's just less hassle to maintain, furnish, clean. You're not keeping up with the Joneses. Moving to cars. I've said this before, too. A $25,000 Toyota, even a $10,000 Toyota or a Subaru is not only less expensive, but more reliable than a Mercedes, BMW, or Jaguar that costs two or three times as much. You're not only going to pay less, but you're most likely going to get equally good or better instruction if you go to a community college or Cal State than if you went to Berkeley or Stanford. And those places, Harvard, Ivy Leagues, Berkeley, Stanford, they will hire terrible teachers as long as they bring in big research dollars. That's crazy. When community college is free, where the community colleges hire exclusively based on how well somebody teaches. The top, all of that, if you can manage to shun status, it means you can pursue, as I said earlier, jobs and careers that are more fulfilling and less stressful, even though they pay less, because you don't need so much money to pay for that lofty lifestyle. You can be a teacher if you want. You can be in the creative arts, maybe. You can run a home-based business rather than some high-pay, high-pressure career, like I was saying, insurance or real estate or being a surgeon. Being a doctor takes so many years of stressful school and so much debt, and then you're really under stress and cost control pressures, and God, it's hard. right? Corporate lawyers, bond traders that go after the big money, but there's a hell of a lot of unhappy people in those big money fields. All right. Without even giving out the phone number, I got calls. So I'm going to take a call and then I'm going to go back to some more of my attempts at work-related wisdom. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, Marty. My name is Andrew, and I'm an avid listener of the show, and I'm really interested in the politics of work and the mechanics of work, and you've given some great advice tonight, as always, and it's really great to hear that. I have some experience with labor organizations and unions, and a previous caller talked about some issues that they are facing in the workplace regarding airline mergers and the stress that they deal about safety. And, you know, I'm not involved in that merger or any of those labor organizations, but I'm pretty sure that that caller was speaking specifically about an airline that might have been owned by Richard Branson and maybe a merger with one with an Eskimo, or excuse me, an Inuit, on the tail section. Now, without getting into too many specifics, I know that for the people that were workers at those unions, they had two different labor organizations representing flight attendants, and that there may be a lack of familiarity about the actual structure, but where there is a labor organization, one of the great things that I really like about my job's in a very stressful industry, and I really think it's important, you know, to call out how much doing something that you love and having a job that's being of service and being useful and having a really good relationship wherever possible with your employer is fantastic. But I belong to a union, and I think that caller also belongs to a union. And I think their collective bargaining agreements have grievance and arbitration language. And so rather than maybe getting a group of people together and signing a letter, maybe they should actually go to their union and have their union represent them over a safety issue and maybe have them even breach the subject with the employer before anybody signs their name to anything. And I wondered if you have any thoughts on how concerted activity and workers getting together to make their jobs better, how that might be a situation where that caller their union might be able to do something for them in that situation.
Excellent call. I got it. I like the idea of not calling in the legals prematurely. I love your addition to my suggestion. I think you start by trying to resolve problems informally, because once you do it formally, you harden positions. I would rather see, and I'd started with collective action. I said, the 10 of you employees, get together and make the list of your top things that you want to learn and go to your boss. That feels collaborative. It's not going to be retaliatory. It's not going to be oppositional. It's not going to be expensive. If that doesn't work, I love your second tier suggestion. Then you have a really excellent basis to go to the unions and say, look, we did try to resolve this as a informal management issue. They blew us off completely. So I really appreciate your call. Thanks very much for calling the show.
Thanks for the distinction. I really like what you had to say in response. I really appreciate you being there.
I appreciate you liking the show. Take care. Okay. I want to make sure, we only have a few minutes left. I wanted to share some more of these attempts, hopefully not too feeble attempts, at my thoughts about what are there really statements of wisdom that I can make regarding the world of work, not just pragmatic, you know, things that work. And this is one of my favorites. I like to think that I walk the talk. I do practice what I preach. Is to weigh is in W-E-I-G-H, as in weight. Weigh contribution over happiness. This was the first idea, actually, that came to my mind for me when I was thinking about this show and trying to make a list of things I felt were wisdom. Yeah, the pursuit of happiness is deified in the Declaration of Independence. But the contributory, less happy person, in my mind, has lived a life much better led than the happier, less contributory person. So, and that's true even if you're a bricklayer. If you, let's say you're making that discretionary determination between at hour 40, let's say you're a self-employed bricklayer and you've put in your 40 hours and you have a choice between going home and drinking a six-pack or playing video games or whatever, or you got a call from somebody who would really like to have that security fence built. She's feeling insecure at her home. And even though you'd have to work, it's after your 40 hours. The person, that bricklayer, who would go and do that, create that brick wall, in my mind, is a hero, is somebody who has weighed contribution over his happiness. He'd be a lot happier with the beer or the video games or TV or the movie or being with his girlfriend or whatever. But I really respect that. And of course, the example I've given previously is a more extreme example. It is very difficult to imagine Mother Teresa was happy amid the sewage stench of Calcutta's streets, her ankles ever bitten by scorpions. And yet, most people would agree that, I mean, she had, I've had callers call and say, she wasn't so perfect. But you would agree that her life was better led than if she was, say, a hedonist who did spend as much time as possible on sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I'm not saying that, you know, to prioritize contribution, you got to go to Calcutta. As I said with the bricklayer example, whatever you do. But I'm simply advising or suggesting, as this attempt at wisdom, that as you weigh how to spend your time, to keep top of mind the idea that contribution is primary, maybe much more so than the much vaunted pursuit of happiness. I've got time, for one more. Another one is, my attempt at wisdom, is do good and certainly no evil. This is kind of a paraphrase of Google's first corporate slogan, and it speaks to me. I mean, there's nothing wrong with acting in your own interest, but do weigh the net cost to others. For example, if you're listening to this show, you know that I've often touted Trader Joe's. Well, Trader Joe's has just shortened its hours at my local store, the one on College Avenue in Oakland. They're trying to save money. They're making a fortune already. Well, every time I'm there between 9 and 10 p.m., which is they've just cut out that hour, which is my favorite time to go, there's a reasonable number of people there. And for people to be willing to come out and shop between 9 and 10 at night, it must be a real benefit to them. But that didn't seem to matter at all to Trader Joe's, so much for we put our customers first. So this notion of do good and certainly no evil is not a bad piece of advice. Okay, I got time for more. So the other one, the next one is just do it. Now, just because that's a corporate slogan that's gone become a cliche doesn't invalidate its psychological underpinnings. That additional rumination increases your risk of erroneous inaction more than the risks of just doing it. I mean, I've seen so many clients procrastinate to try to figure it out. Maybe they'll get guaranteed clarity. Normally, it's better to try it out and revise. Even if you fail, as you know, this is a cliche, there's a lot that can be learned from failure. And in having taken action, you're going to gain in your sense of self-efficacy. I have time, I think, for one more. Consider doing your career preparation outside of the halls of academia, on the job, apprenticeship, self-teaching, maybe, yeah, augmented by an online course, an in-person course. And community colleges and university extension programs like UC Berkeley Extension tend to be particularly good at career preparation because they're longer on practice than theory. I have time for one more. I said this to a previous caller. I want to reiterate it here. Build on your strengths. Remediate your weaknesses only to the extent that's crucial to your personal and professional success. One more. I can't help it. Seek the right level of granularity. A major cause of inefficiency is doing things too perfectionistically or too slapdash, too little or too much focus on the details. Of course, sometimes we choose to be granular because it's fun or crucial, but don't just default to either high granularity or low granularity. Decide on a case-by-case basis. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. I love your calls. You're all great. Really, I'm not just saying that. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, my wife and I are going to interview her favorite novelist, Elizabeth George, on what it's really like to be a mystery writer. Plus, we're going to demonstrate something called the joint story. It's a technique that has helped many of my clients move forward. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.